Welcome, everyone, to our next series on the Build and Revitalize podcast. I'm Jason Chaney, Senior Consultant and Due Diligence Discipline Lead with SME, and your host for this series on environmental due diligence. A couple months ago, Dave and I were out having a beverage and waxing poetic on the topic of due care obligations. You can only imagine the crowd that gathered around us. That moment was the birth of this multi-part series. We'll be covering the importance of due diligence prior to property transactions, what to do after acquisition, risks associated with property acquisition, and what happens when things don't go to plan. I'm happy to have Arthur Siegel and Dave Guevara with Taft Law and Brett Stuntz back with me to cover today's topic. And we're going to talk today about what happens after the phase one and phase two are finished and you've acquired a property. Dave, how are you today?
I'm doing well, Jason. Thank you.
Arthur, glad to have you back.
Glad to be here. Thanks.
Brett, you ready to go?
I am.
All right. So today we're going to talk about the importance of due care. So Dave and Arthur, what's next? We bought a property. We found contamination. What do we have to do now?
Well, Jason, in episode one, we discussed the bona fide prospective purchaser defense to CERCLA liability. And we talked about, in order to qualify for the bona fide prospective purchaser defense, a purchaser must satisfy 8 criteria. 3 are threshold requirements, and 5 are continuing obligations. The 3 threshold requirements are: all disposal of hazardous substances at the facility must have occurred prior to the purchaser acquiring title to the facility. 2, and this isn't in any particular order, the purchaser is not affiliated with any person that is potentially liable. And 3, the purchaser must have made all appropriate inquiry. And as we discussed in episode one, this can be accomplished through an ASTM compliant phase one. Now, there are 5 post-acquisition duties, and I want to just talk about one of those, and that is the duty to exercise appropriate care with respect to hazardous substances found at the facility. And in order to do that and satisfy your all appropriate inquiry, you need to 1, stop a continuing release, 2, prevent any threatened future release, and 3, prevent or limit exposure to any previously released hazardous substances. So we found contamination. What do we do now? At least with respect to the bona fide prospective purchaser defense and establishing an exemption to CERCLA liability, the purchaser has to exercise appropriate care by doing the 3 things that I just mentioned. And oftentimes it comes down to the 3rd, which is preventing or limiting exposure to previously released hazardous substances.
What happens if I don't prepare a plan, or, you know, I prepare the plan and then just decide I'm not going to implement it?
Well, before we even get into that, let me just say, in Michigan, and every state has different rules, and wherever the property is, you need to understand those rules first and foremost. In Michigan, we have a program, and I mentioned it in the earlier episode, the BEA program, the Baseline Environmental Assessment. And what that means is that you basically do your phase one, do your phase two, find your environmental contamination, assuming that there is some. If you don't find any, you stop and that's the end. You fall into that due diligence safe harbor we talked about, if there's some out there that you just couldn't find. But if you find contamination, then you prepare this baseline environmental assessment and you submit it to the state of Michigan. And it basically goes of record, and you're effectively documenting the conditions as they are at the time, effectively, of acquisition, occupancy, or if you're a lender, foreclosure. Doing that protects you from liability for the cleanup for that contamination. You still have those kinds of obligations, that due care obligation that Dave mentioned. In Michigan, that's your next step. It's a step that doesn't come up in other states, but it's a step here in Michigan. Kentucky, I believe, has a very similar program. They don't call it that, but I think it works very much the same way. Ohio has more of a self-implementing program where you don't have to submit something to the state, but you still have to figure out sort of what's out there first. Do you prepare a plan? Well, there's the practical and there's the legal. The practical is if you don't prepare a plan, how are you going to know if you're doing what you're supposed to be doing? How do you know that you're not making matters worse? How do you know that you're not preventing exposures? How do you know that you haven't shut off an existing release? The things that Dave was just talking about. So there's really no way to tell. So if, like, one of the things you're supposed to do is don't dig up contaminated dirt and put it someplace it's not supposed to go. If you haven't written that down anywhere, yeah, you might remember it this week, this month, this year, but a year from now or 2 years or 5 years from now, when somebody else is running the property for your company, they may not remember that. They may not know that. Now you hope, unlike manuals that sit on the shelf and gather dust, you hope that you have a relatively simple plan that makes it clear what you are and are not supposed to do. So if you don't write it down, you're likely to run afoul and have a problem. That's first and foremost. Secondly, and so having a plan gives you sort of defensive medicine, if you will. Secondly, at least here in Michigan, the state will come and ask for your plan. They want to see if you have something written down so that they can basically measure your activities against. If it says you're going to maintain a paved area or a landscaped area under which there's contaminated materials that people shouldn't come into contact with, they're going to want to see where that area is and is it maintained? Or is the paved area falling into, you know, crumbling into dust? Or is the landscaped area eroding away so that people could be coming into contact with contaminated materials? So basically, the state wants you to have a written plan.
And Jason, there's a standard, there's an ASTM standard for continuing obligations, for identifying continuing obligations and then devising a plan to address them. And I always have the environmental consultant prepare for the client what I call a continuing obligations assessment letter that identifies the contaminant impacts and identifies what the client needs to do in order to prevent or limit exposure to previously released hazardous substances. So Arthur's absolutely right. Without a written plan in place, obviously it's difficult to execute and implement on that in any sort of consistent or effective way.
I want to ask about that client communication part. When I think about due care, continuing obligations, there's someone acquires a property, maybe they redevelop a property, then they operate a developed property. You might have different due care, continuing obligations requirements at different phases because the conditions are different on the property. The use is different on the property. And then we're asking often clients to do things maybe that they don't have experience doing. If it's an engineered control, it might take some expertise or different physical plant staff or something like that. So how do you go about advising clients on what's coming down the pike, what they should be expecting? When do we have these conversations? How can we kind of set level expectations for developers and property owners?
Well, I think generally, Brett, the answer to when you have the conversation is early. You want people to know going in that they are going to have some sort of obligation, assuming we find contamination, from the get-go. I mean, as you're educating them about the due diligence process in Michigan, the BEA program, how is it going to work? What are you going to have to do? At least give them some idea that they are going to have an obligation going forward. I think that's the right time to do it. As the contamination comes into focus, then I think you have to revisit the issue and say, remember when we talked about this? Here's what this is going to mean for you. At least that's the way I would approach it. And it may, it ranges. And I've told people at the outset, it may be just simply maintaining everything exactly as it is. Maintain the status quo. Make sure that your landscaping stays landscaped. Make sure that your paved areas stay paved. Make sure that you don't get cracks in the floor, those sorts of things. It can be as simple as that, and documenting that you've checked it, twice or four times a year to make sure that you've checked those boxes. There are some other tasks that Michigan will require that I know you're familiar with. You can start with that, but then you have to say to them, well, but if we find there's a vapor intrusion issue, or there's a fire explosion risk, or there's a continuing release, as Dave mentioned, that there's going to be more that you have to do. You have to step up and do more. So while we told you that you're not liable to clean it up, that's not the end. That doesn't mean that, as I said in the last podcast, that it's not a panacea. It's not a get out of jail free card. There are obligations that come along with owning a piece of property that's contaminated. And I think it has to be a continuing education process.
And Brett, I couldn't agree more than with what Arthur just said. In fact, what we generally do during our due diligence inspection period, the phase one occurs. If there's a wreck, we do a phase two. We, in consultation with the consultant, the client, we try and put those costs on a pro forma just to make a determination as to whether or not the acquisition makes sense, because we're able to make some of those determinations, right? Because we do the phase one, there's recognized environmental conditions. We do a phase two, we investigate those. And so at that point, we're able to make a determination as to what those continuing obligations are going to be. We're able to cost that out, put it in a pro forma, and make a determination as to whether or not this acquisition still makes sense. And that happens before title even transfers.
So just to give you an example, and I agree with Dave, and we try to do that as well. Always, I always try to do that with whoever I'm working with, to the extent that I can. But I mean, just to give you an example, if you had a metalworking shop where there was likely chlorinated solvents, or a dry cleaning plant, either or, similar kinds of contamination, similar kind of risk. Mm-hmm. So you might need to have your worst case scenario is you got to retrofit the building with a subslab depressurization system to keep the vapors out from the building that might be underneath the floor of the building. Yeah. Well, what's the average price for something like that? Is it $15 a square foot? Well, if you've, you know, you take that figure, you multiply it by the number of square feet, you tell your client who's looking at an acquisition, it's going to cost you $150,000 more to deal with that, or depending on the size of the building, $1.5 million more. And that may change their mind as to whether or not they want to proceed with the transaction at all.
What about different states? If you're doing business in Ohio, Indiana, Michigan, you're going to obviously have continuing obligations or due care obligations, but does it make a big difference if you're looking to locate a business one place or the other?
I guess I don't think so. I think, and Dave described sort of the key elements, you know, like I said, every state has its own rules and you've got to look at that. For example, in Michigan, you've got to notify the holders of utility easements of the contamination. So they know that if they come out to dig a sewer line or replace a power line or gas line or something like that, that they might be dealing with contamination. So that's something that's different. You've got to notify the neighboring property owners if there's a reasonable potential of offsite migration so that the neighbors know that this might be happening. I'm not liable for it. I didn't cause it. I did a BEA, but I'm telling you, perhaps most importantly for a lot of transactions, particularly when you're looking at residential, Michigan requires that when you do the baseline environmental assessment, that you notify not only the state, as I mentioned, but that you notify future transferees of an interest in the property. So that may mean that you, not necessarily may, I think everyone pretty much agrees that it does mean that you need to notify your tenants if you're acting as a landlord. If you're doing a residential development, you may need to tell anybody who's buying a house from you that this property is contaminated. That has driven, I think, still to this day, a lot of stick-built homes, single-family individual homes, away from, or developers away from those kinds of developments in contaminated sites that aren't fully cleaned up. So you got to look at each state's rules to see what's required. But the basic rule of thumb is don't make matters worse, don't exacerbate it, and as Dave said, prevent unacceptable exposures. And what that means really depends on how the property is going to be developed, how it's going to be used, and what the contamination is. So it's a case-by-case determination.
Over time, fall within what is defined as a hazardous substance. We know criteria changes over time. And what regulatory agencies view as sufficient for due care changes over time. Do owners of properties have to keep up on that? Do they have to look back at their past conditions as the regulatory environment changes? If you do your due diligence and you do your assessment and you exercise due care based on what was understood at the time of the transaction, things change later. What happens then?
That is a great and scary question. Dave, what do you tell your clients?
Well, in a situation like that, to be risk averse, I think we would want to react in response to a change, for instance, in regulation. So let's say Arthur was talking about impacts to soil that volatilize and then collect in an above ground structure. If at the time of acquisition, the result of the regulation was you didn't need to put in a subside depressurization system, but then the regulations change. You still have the obligation to prevent or limit exposure to previously released hazardous substances. And therefore, in order to be risk averse, I would advise the client to address that through the implementation of a subside depressurization system.
I think that's good advice. My answer is pretty much complementary to that. I would say, from a liability standpoint, I think if you're not liable, you're not liable. I don't think that you are likely to see what's called a reopener in those kinds of situations. Nobody's going to come back and say, from the federal government, from the state, and say, well, you got your liability protection, but now we know there's a problem. You're now liable. I don't think you have to worry about that. In terms of due care, as Dave was saying, I think there does need to be a recognition that things evolve and that there may be changes that change the way you have to approach it. I mean, if you had a property with a BEA from 15 years ago, and things change in terms of what's sort of the hot topic of the day. We were talking during a break about PFAS, and we may talk more about that today. That was something that, other than one of our colleagues, 10 years ago, I would say hardly any environmental lawyers were aware of. Vapor intrusion, realistically, again, about 10 years ago, was very little thought about. And people didn't really worry about that. The big issue was direct contact. Are you going to touch something? Are you going to basically be, you know, touching dirt or breathing dirt particles that are contaminated? Or are you going to be drinking water that's contaminated? Those were the two big concerns. Now we have other drivers. Are you going to be breathing air, as Dave said, inside a building, or I suppose outside as well, that might be contaminated at a level that might make somebody sick? We weren't talking about that 10 or 15 years ago so much. So the answer to your question is you've got to prepare your client conservatively to say things can change and it's possible. I would say the answer is yes, definitely. If you had a BEA on a piece of property 15 or 20 years ago that there was chlorinated solvents in the soils or groundwater, but they were below the state's levels of concern for direct contact, or they were, you know, there was enough distance between the surface that you didn't need to worry about it, you weren't thinking about vapor intrusion. If the state came out tomorrow and said, you know, you've got this vapor issue, which we didn't talk about 20 years ago, you got to do something about it because there is an unacceptable level of exposure. And that's, as Dave said, that's one of the three main criteria that you've got to look at. Then you've got to look at it. And in fact, I can think of one property in a little town in Oakland County, Michigan, that the state came out. There was an old dry cleaner there. And the state came out and actually shut the property down itself and caused a cleanup to occur because there had been a former dry cleaner there and they were concerned about that vapor intrusion issue. Whether there was a BEA there or not, or the parties were not liable or not, I don't know. But it absolutely can happen that those changed circumstances lead to a change in approach. I think the state, unless there's a significant risk to human health, the state tries to stay away from it, or at least makes that a lower priority. But clients, people buying pieces of property, need to understand that that's a risk.
So guys, are there any differences in federal and state due care requirements? Is it all one, or will certain states say you need to do more or less? I mean, how does that work?
In Indiana, Indiana adopts the CERCLA standard. So in Indiana, that's going to be, they're going to mirror each other. It may be different in Michigan.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I guess I want to answer a slightly different question. There are also differences in the liability standards. There are certain states, as Dave said, that mirror the federal standards, the federal law. So, you know, and I'm not sure about Indiana, I'm going to put you on the spot. If there are certain states that if you buy a piece of property and you qualify for the bona fide purchaser protection, I believe in that state, you will qualify as well under state law. In some states, they have not modified their state statutes. And so they still operate as if it were pre-2002. So you may have liability in one state for contamination where you meet all the criteria for the bona fide purchaser protection, but you don't get that protection. So there's that risk. And of course, as we've talked about a couple of times, there are certain states that have their own liability protection programs, Michigan being one of them. So you got to look at different liability standards to begin with. And then to go to the issue of due care, I think absolutely you've got to expect different states to approach it differently, but the core of them are going to be largely the same. Don't make matters worse, because you're going to be liable if you cause that kind of a problem. And as Dave said, absolutely ensure that there are not human health impacts from known contamination. I think those two, I would be surprised if you looked at, I've never done a 50 state survey on this, but I would be surprised if you looked at all 50 states and found that there was any state that didn't apply those two. But as I said, in Michigan, you got to give notice of offsite migration. You've got to give notice to tenants and to future purchasers. I'm not sure every other state requires that.
And Arthur's exactly right. Some states, we obviously represent clients in all 50 states, and some states don't adopt the bona fide prospective purchaser defense. But then some states, like Indiana, actually expand the scope of the liability protection. So under the federal law, it only applies to hazardous substances. Under Indiana law, it applies to hazardous substances and petroleum. So as Arthur said, it's a state-by-state analysis that needs to be performed.
Arthur, you shared a good example there about what can happen, with the state coming in and saying, hey, you need to shut your building down. There's a potential vapor risk, right? Is there an example you can share of somebody you've worked with or you've seen where somebody actually did everything they needed to do and then just forgot to maintain their due care obligations? You know, Arthur mentioned a parking lot crumbling to dust, right? That's pretty easy to happen, especially where we're working. You freeze thaw, parking lots crack. That could be an issue. Do you guys have any examples of that you could share?
I don't have any examples, but we are very adamant about ensuring that the obligations outlined in our continuing obligations assessment letters are performed, executed upon, and monitored periodically. So we look back on that with the client on schedule. We calendar the meetings to occur and ensure that we're continuing to satisfy those obligations. But for doing that, as Arthur said before, if you don't have something written, if you're not being conscientious about it, if you have another facility manager who begins to operate the facility at a time later on, you may not continue to perform in a way that would satisfy those obligations. So it's a great question, but there are means that you can execute on to ensure that you're not dropping the ball.
And I appreciate Dave's approach. I think that's a great approach. Unfortunately, there are clients who say, okay, you've handed me my due care plan. You've gotten me through my liability protection. I'm done. I don't want to pay you any more legal fees or any more consulting fees. I can do this on my own. I can have my plan and I can have my people implement it. And I don't need any more help. Thank you very much. And sometimes they do. And I suspect sometimes that plan gets thrown on a shelf under something else and gathers dust. And the guy who's running the facility, perhaps the person who's responsible for maintenance, over time either changes or forgets about it or gets busy and things do slack off. I'm reasonably certain that happens. And I have seen cases where folks, not necessarily in the due care per se situation, but I've seen situations where over time, memories fade and people, aren't as sensitive. And candidly, the state isn't as aggressive in inspecting that or pursuing that as maybe they could be. And so there's not a whole lot of impetus other than it's the right thing to do and it's required for them to stay on top of that. And I can think of a situation, it wasn't a due care situation, but it was something similar where we had a client that had operated a small manufacturing company that had they were making metal tubing, a lot of, a lot of oils, a lot of cleaning solvents, a lot of stuff like that. And it was all draining into a system. And ultimately it would come into an oil water separator. And while they were operating it, they were very diligent about skimming the oil off. The water ultimately would flow into a surface drain. And ultimately wind up running to a surface water body eventually. And the property got sold and they handed it over and said, well, this is how you do it. And then it got sold again. It may have been sold one more time, I'm not sure. And whoever the owner was at that point had lost track of this issue. They didn't even know that the oil water separator was there. They weren't manufacturing tubing anymore. They were doing something completely different. It was a warehousing operation at that point. And so there was oil under the footprint of the building, basically, that over time drained back into this oil water separator. Since nobody was maintaining it, it overflowed and the oil would flow out into the surface drain. And eventually somebody saw a sheen on this surface drain and called the state. The state came out, traced it back to this property. And then, of course, there was a big old fight, and that's why people have lawyers. But the answer to the question is it's human nature. People, over time, unless they have somebody like Dave or like me or like you who's engaged with them and is making sure that they're doing what they're supposed to be doing, there's always going to be instances where somebody's going to slip up and just forget.
And this goes back to a question that you had, Brett, which is, when do you have these conversations with the client? You have the conversation, as Arthur said, real early on, and you try and quantify those costs. You try and put it on the pro forma. You make a determination as to whether those costs over time is something that the client can bear. And if it can't, then maybe that transaction isn't appropriate for the client.
So what are the ramifications if you don't do it? What happens if you lose your BFPP status because you didn't maintain your parking lot?
So this is a fantastic question because we haven't really addressed it. So what if you're an RP, right? If you're a responsible party, you have to characterize the contamination both on and off site, and then you have to remediate that depending on what the site use is where that contamination has migrated. So let's say that it's gone half a mile off the site through commercial facilities and residential facilities. You need to go in there and you need to characterize that contamination, then you need to remediate it depending on the site use. And that also opens you up then to, you know, toxic tort claims from the offsite residents for trespass, negligence, nuisance, and certainly those damages can be very high. So the risk of failing to execute upon your continuing obligations is there, and the harm for not doing it is potentially severe.
So it's way cheaper to maintain your parking lot than to chase contamination 2 miles down the road.
It goes back to what we all learned as kids: an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. There's no two ways about it. I will say, Michigan at least is a little, shall we say, less draconian than the federal standard is, or the federal approach is. At least here in Michigan, the you are liable for the contamination or the consequences of your failure to act. So it doesn't necessarily convert it. You don't lose your BEA protection, if you will, from liability from that. So if you fail to exercise due care, and for lack of a better word, nothing bad happens, then really you don't suffer that much in the way of consequences. On the other hand, if you fail to exercise due care and something bad does happen, you're going to be on the hook for all of that expense. So again, using the example that you were using with the the parking lot, if the parking lot crumbles into dust and then there is a direct exposure risk, somebody could come into contact with contamination that's right under where the parking lot used to be. If it doesn't get mobilized, if the rainwater doesn't push it into, you know, off-site or into a surface water body, but it just sort of sits there and nobody comes into contact with it, yeah, there can be a sanction for failure to follow due care. I'm not sure that I know if there's a dollar amount necessarily assigned to that in the statute, but they could try to fine you for that. But in terms of liability, it doesn't necessarily undo all of your other liability protection. Your liability protection stays in place, but you would obviously suffer some consequence for failure to exercise due care.
But it's important for your audience to understand that any state law isn't going to preempt federal law. So while it is true that in this instance, in this example, that there may not be any penalties for failure to follow through on your continuing obligations that are going to flow from the state, they could flow from the federal government through the EPA. So you always have to have your eyes on both the state and the federal government.
Absolutely.
All right, guys, that was great. Arthur, I love the ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. I think that's a great place to end this one. So thank you guys for being here again. Appreciate it. Our next episode is going to cover insurance recovery and other financial incentives to deal with contamination on brownfield sites. So thank you all very much.
Thank you, Jason.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for tuning in to the Build and Revitalize podcast series on environmental due diligence, produced by SME. We've learned a lot from Jason, Dave, Arthur, and Brett in our first two episodes, and they'll be back again soon to talk about insurance recovery and financial incentives. Be sure to subscribe to Build and Revitalize on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And don't forget to visit www.sme-usa.com/podcast to join the conversation, access show notes, and catch up on previous episodes. While you're at it, connect with SME USA on LinkedIn, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube.